If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hello, snack lovers. Curb your cravings with My Mochi ice cream. Imagine a scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream in your favorite flavor. Now imagine that scoop wrapped up in the sweetest, softest dough known to mankind. That's My Mochi ice cream. Sweet, chewy, cool, and creamy, all in one bite. It's quite possibly the most joyfully chill sensation you've ever had in your life. My Mochi ice cream comes in tons of fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are about 80 calories each, and it's also gluten-free. You can find My Mochi at Target or visit MyMochi.com to find a grocery store near you. That's MyMochi.com. Discover the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
Hey, everybody, this is a special episode of Late Night Podcast. We're going to be chatting about the 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner with hosts of Pod Save America and founders of Crooked Media, Jon Favreau, John Lovett, and Tommy Vidor. It's a crossover episode. It's going to be appearing on Late Night Podcast and Pod Save America. So subscribe to the Late Night Podcast on iTunes. Before we get to that conversation, here is a closer look at Trump's inauguration preparation. Donald Trump will be sworn in tomorrow as the 45th president of the United States. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. We are about to witness a landmark moment in American history tomorrow, not just the inauguration of a new president, but the inauguration of a president who may very well be the least popular incoming president in modern history.
Donald Trump will become president on Friday with record low approval ratings. Just 32% of Americans have a favorable view of the president-elect, and that's lower than any president-elect that CBS News has measured going back to Ronald Reagan back in 1981.
President-elect Trump is taking office with the lowest approval ratings that anybody can find in recent memory. Yeah.
Can you feel the excitement? It's like getting ready for the Super Bowl if the Super Bowl was the Cleveland Browns versus players who were cut by the Cleveland Browns. And yet, despite his record low approval ratings and the fact that he hasn't even taken office yet, Trump told the Washington Post in an interview Wednesday that he's already got a campaign slogan for 2020. Here's how the Post described that conversation. Halfway through his interview, Trump shared a bit of news. He already has decided on his slogan for a re-election bid in 2020. Are you ready, he said? Keep America great, exclamation point. Keep America great? You haven't done anything yet. You're like a guy who goes into a job interview and talks about plans for his retirement party. I picked out the gold watch you guys should buy me, and it's top notch. But there actually was. There actually was one part of the slogan Trump wasn't totally sure about. Get me my lawyer, the president-elect shouted. 2 minutes later, one arrived. Will you trademark and register Keep America Great with an exclamation point, with and without an exclamation? First of all, get me my lawyer will probably end up being a much more appropriate slogan for President Trump. Second, given how Trump operates, he'll probably start with Keep America Great, exclamation point, then drop the exclamation point, then after Putin threatens to annex Rhode Island, we'll be down to just Keep America. But while Trump is focused on 2020, preparations for this inauguration have apparently been a little rocky. After reports of A-list celebrities refusing invites to his inauguration, Trump tweeted last month, the so-called A-list celebrities are all wanting tickets to the inauguration, but look what they did for Hillary. Nothing. I want the people. Who does he think he is convincing with tweets like that. He sounds like a high school senior getting ready for prom. All the popular girls asked me to go, but I wanted to go with my mom. She's got a driver's license, and she always packs juice boxes. And it's perfectly reasonable to make the case that having celebrities at an inauguration is overrated. That's perfectly reasonable. But Trump's claim that he doesn't want celebrities was undermined by this report from entertainment website The Wrap that claimed, quote, Trump's team is struggling so hard to book A-list performers for his inaugural festivities that it offered ambassadorships to at least two talent bookers if they could deliver marquee names. You get an ambassadorship for booking an inauguration performer? If that were the case, you can bet Chris Christie would be cold calling everyone in the Los Angeles phone book. Please, please, Rihanna, if you do this, I can be ambassador to Chili, and I love Chili's. But Trump's team is apparently not worried. In fact, the chair of his inaugural committee explained to CNN that, in a way, the inaugural ceremonies would feature plenty of celebrities.
We have three of the greatest celebrities in the world here already. We have President Obama, number one celebrity in the world as it exists today. We have this, Washington, D.C., which is a stage that is incomparable anywhere in the world. And we have the president-elect, Donald Trump.
So your three celebrities are two people who have to be there and the city it takes place in? And also, the sun will be overhead tomorrow, and everybody loves the sun. And need I remind you, the sun is literally a huge star, so that's four. So Trump's team has insisted they don't care about the fanfare or the lack of celebrities. In fact, a spokesman for the inaugural committee said they were intentionally scaling back the typical theatrics because, quote, the inauguration ceremony ultimately is about getting to work. That's right. It's all about getting to work. So I assume we can expect to see Trump at his desk signing executive orders as soon as he's done with the ceremony, right?
Though his term officially begins at noon on Friday, Trump said in an interview with the Times of London that the work will begin in earnest next week, saying he will sign orders beginning, quote, day one, which I will consider to be Monday as opposed to Friday or Saturday, right? I mean, my day one is going to be Monday because I don't want to be signing and getting it mixed up with lots of celebration.
Yeah, totally makes sense. Take the weekend off. In fact, take the next 4 years off. You earned it, buddy. Working so hard at those rallies. And then there's the question of what Trump will say in his speech. It's a crucial moment for a man entering office with historically low approval ratings to prove himself to his critics and try to unite the country. And to prove that he's personally writing the speech, Trump tweeted this photo yesterday with the caption, "Writing my inaugural address at the Winter White House Mar-a-Lago 3 weeks ago. Looking forward to Friday. Time to connect with the American people. Jeeves, fetch my writing cufflinks." He has the face of that dude with a laptop at Starbucks who you know is never finishing that screenplay. Open on Space Monsters. Now, to preview their inaugural addresses, presidents often give clues by mentioning who they're drawing inspiration from. In 2009, Barack Obama said he'd been reading Abraham Lincoln speeches to prepare. So what's Trump been reading? Well, some reporters tried to ask him during an interview in his Trump Tower office this week which books he's read that he would recommend. And he gave this cryptic answer, quote, "I like a lot of books. I like reading books. I don't have the time to read very much now in terms of the books, but I like reading them." I don't have the time to read very much now in terms of the books. He sounds like an alien pretending to be a high school student. "I very much love the skateboarding and the kissing with the girls. And also, I'm going to prom with my mom. My choice." We did get a little more information about Trump's reading habits in that interview, though. When Trump was asked about his intelligence briefings, quote, "Trump says he likes his briefings short, ideally one page if it's in writing. I like bullets, or I like as little as possible. Ideally, I like my security briefings delivered via fortune cookie. Because that way, even if it's bad news, you still have the cookie." The most exciting thing about tomorrow's inauguration is this. The moment Trump takes his hand off that Bible tomorrow, he may very well be in violation of the Constitution. That's because he is not divested from his company or put his holdings in a blind trust. Even the chief ethics lawyer for George W. Bush has said as much.
Do you believe he is going to be in violation of the Constitution when he takes that oath on Friday?
I believe yes, if he does not make sure that all the foreign government payments, that all of that money is not out of the Trump Organization by Friday when he takes the oath, he will be in violation of the Constitution.
I guess that explains the inaugural schedule. Noon swearing in, 3 p.m. inaugural parade, 6 p.m. impeachment hearing. And then... there's the fact that when Trump does officially take office, he'll be relying on a cabinet consisting mostly of incredibly unqualified people who seem either unprepared for or actively hostile to the jobs they're taking, like his pick for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. At one point, DeVos was asked how she felt about guns in schools, which would seem to most people like a no-brainer, slam-dunk answer, and gave this baffling response.
Do you think that guns have any place in or around schools?
I think that's best left to locales and states to decide. If the underlying question is...
You can't say definitively today that guns shouldn't be in schools?
Well, I will refer back to Senator Enzi and the school that he was talking about in Wapiti, Wyoming. I think probably there, I would imagine that there's probably a gun in the school to protect from potential grizzlies.
That's right, you need guns in schools to protect from grizzly bears. But what do you do about the grizzlies who are undercover? Are you sure? You better be sure before you take the shot, because that may be a grizzly. Or it's a super hairy kid. I need a gun in school, because I brought my mom to prom and a bear ate her. But the finest moment of the confirmation hearing so far was from Trump's nominee for Energy Secretary, Rick Perry, who would be in charge of our nation's nuclear arsenal. Again, this is a clip from a man who would be in charge of our nuclear arsenal.
Thank you so much for coming into my office. Did you enjoy meeting me?
I hope you were as much fun on that dais as you were on your couch.
Well...
May I rephrase that, sir?
Please. Please.
This has been a closer look.
Late Night Podcast is available every Wednesday and Friday on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please take a moment to leave us a rating and review. Now, back to the show.
Crossover pod. It's like when Spider-Man and Batman are in a comic together.
It's exactly like that.
It is.
How you doing, Seth?
I'm doing good.
How you feeling? We always like to ask everyone how they're feeling.
I'm feeling pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking what is the actual day? It's the day before the inauguration.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's an interesting day to check in on people's feelings, I feel
yep.
like. It's funny, people were asking me the other day, what do I expect tomorrow? And I've given up on expectations and voicing them and talking about them.
It's been easy to sort of forget about this because, like, Barack Obama was a security blanket who was there. But being in the White House yesterday and, like, seeing literal moving boxes going out of the Oval Office was a hard visual for me.
Plus, they're stealing all those busts.
Yeah.
And that's going to be like a big scandal.
It's going to be a huge scandal. How long do they have their boxes there? Is it like when regular people move?
No, they have to phase them because they can't physically check you all out at once. So it's like it's this rolling, depressing departure photo process. And he's there on the last day. And
it was a little sad.
Yeah.
It was a little sad.
You guys got your interview, though.
We did get our interview.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for
capitalism. So during our interview, Lovett asked Obama if he feels responsible for Trump running because of the Correspondents' Dinner in 2011.
The 2011, where we all worked together.
What a funny night.
Who had the last laugh there?
Well, people say, some people on Twitter said, who's had the last laugh? Or who's laughing now? Trump fans have said to me, who's laughing now? And to that I say, still us.
Yeah.
He doesn't
still
laugh.
Funny.
I've
he
never
doesn't
seen
laugh.
Him laugh.
No.
So he won, yes, but I don't. I think laughing's the wrong thing to put on him.
Yeah. When you were preparing for that speech, which is a hard one.
Yeah.
And you did great.
Thanks. It was a fun night. No, you guys did great with the president.
How much did you think about targeting Trump? Like, when did that sort of come up in your mind that was going to be a focus of?
We worked on it for about 3 weeks. Because we had 3 weeks on from SNL, and there were about 8 people that helped me out with it. We had a lot of people writing a lot of jokes. And I remember The president releasing his long-form birth certificate was a huge bummer for us because it took away a lot of jokes.
Us too. Same here. Yeah. We got angry when we were told this.
When we heard that there was like something going on and we might get wind of something that was like newsworthy that was going to end up in the briefing room, we were like, it's going to be the birth certificate. It's going to be tonight of all nights. It's going to be the birth certificate 3 days before the speech.
Yeah. And it was. And then, but Trump was really like, bubbling up in the days leading up to it, I feel like it was getting worse and worse because it hadn't occurred to us 3 weeks out how big a part Trump would be. And then as it got closer, I think it really occurred to us, oh, this will be, and what a gift. You know, what a replacement for the birth certificate thing is that he's, and I think it was also that he was going to be there.
Right.
Like once that was announced, then it got really fun because you think it's, there's a lot of fun people in the room, but it's, there aren't really.
No. It's Washington.
Yeah. It's a tough crowd too.
It's a tough crowd. Also, It was unique that they could cut to Trump because usually that it's not like the Golden Globes where they cut to the people as you're making jokes to them. The C-SPAN people have no idea where anybody is.
Right.
Right.
The cameras are way far away. There's awful. I mean, again, it was not Donald Trump's fault that night, but it was the least flattering shot of him watching himself get burned the whole day. It was that
I was
weird
sitting right
sight.
Behind him.
Yeah.
I was at the table behind him and I could see just him being so pissed the whole time.
C-SPAN had asked me for my script because they wanted to be able to cut to people, and I didn't give it to them for a couple of reasons. One, I didn't want it to be about the cut-tos. Also, I don't know if you guys feel this way. The minute you show it to anybody, I was just worried a C-SPAN producer would flip through my script and not smile, and I would lose all confidence. You just don't want to show anybody anything until it's done.
Yeah.
But the fact that you had so many Trump jokes, by the time I went, C-SPAN knew exactly where he was.
Right.
They had found him
during
the president. It is... It is a really interesting, I mean, I'm not saying anything. Somebody's thought, what a crazy night, because a few people have certainly conjectured that it was one of the moments for him.
Well, I'd heard it whispered for a while, and then they did that Frontline special.
Yeah. Omarosa just said
Omarosa was like, she said that was it. That was the moment he decided he was going to take his revenge at some point.
Yeah.
It's
she's a serial liar.
Right,
so,
exactly. Yeah.
Grain of salt. It's a great story.
It's a great story.
Right. We're fine, guys.
This is cathartic.
I think he's moved on from, ultimately so many things have happened. I feel like he, although I guess the book on him would be that he has incredibly long memory for vengeance.
Yeah,
but
he's not like a... He's not like a forgive and forget type.
No, I feel like he's a forget guy.
Yeah.
But I don't think forgiveness leads to the forgetting.
I know I hate them, but I can't remember why.
Right, exactly.
Did he ever say anything to you?
Well, I saw him a couple nights later at an event in New York. And in my head, which is sort of something that Lorne Michaels would say, which is don't make a joke about somebody that you wouldn't be able to go up and talk to them after. I did feel every joke was fair. I don't look back on that and think any of it was mean or out of bounds.
Right.
And I went over and said, because I'd known him from when he had hosted SNL, and I went over and said, thanks for being such a good sport the other night. And he completely shut that down. He immediately said, you were too mean. The jokes were too mean.
Oh, boy.
He did say the president was very funny, so congrats, guys.
Nailed it.
Because that was how he always phrased it at post, was that I had stepped over the line.
Right.
I wonder what you did that really got him.
I think it's that there's something, being burned by the president is an honor in its own right.
Right.
I know it's embarrassing to some degree, but with the most powerful man in the world takes time out of his remarks to target you.
Right.
There is a bit of like you have accomplished something to reach that point. Whereas when I go after you, it's like, who is this guy? And then though, I saw him at a... I did not see him again until the SNL 40th, and we actually had a very nice interaction. This is before, probably about like 3 or 4 months before he announced. It was pleasant. And it was not planned. We were just trying to get to our seats and crossing in a very narrow aisle. And it was a real bygones be bygones conversation. And at the time...
And you've been friends ever since.
We've been friends ever since. And everything
he
knows everything. Everything's a joke. I call him every night. I tell him what's coming. I run the script by him. He thinks it's very good to sort of frame somebody as the other side. And then we actually reached out and talked to him about coming on the show because, again, because of 2011 and that correspondence dinner, we always thought he'd be a great guest. And then he, started running and we started talking about it. And that sort of went astray.
Yeah, he doesn't like honesty.
So this is something we were excited to talk to you about, which is how you decided to be political in a show that makes that hard, or at least where there's like a threshold question, like, is this a show that can be political?
Right. It was a couple things. The main,
I feel like the main catalyst was just this decision that was based more in comfort than anything else to move the show back to behind the desk, not do a conventional monologue, which was a thing I just set up as a challenge to myself. I really thought I would have the best joke writers and I would eventually figure out how to do it, and just never found comfort with it. Also, you know, our show's on after The Tonight Show and Jimmy does a monologue, and I think one of the biggest challenges we have every night is how do you get people to stay tuned in? And oftentimes I think when you do something that looks exactly the same, they think, oh, I don't need to see the same kind of jokes about what happened in the news. So we got back behind the desk, and that let us do it a little bit more update style. And when you have updates and keys and graphics, you can tell jokes that I think are a little bit more explain-y. You don't have to do that monologue thing of, hey, did you guys see this? Do you, you know, and that got out of it. And so that just became a little bit newsier. And then we just kind of lucked out that we had just done a few of these closer looks, and they got really good. It was that thing of the audience kind of telling you something's working. We'd get good feedback. And then this all sort of just happened right as Trump jumped into the race. And then this became a year where I feel like all the late night shows, even the ones that are apolitical, started talking about politics a little bit more because we had a more political leaning. It just gave us so much content that we started creating this process, whereas we could do these closer looks 3 or 4 times a week. And as far as the fact that nobody had ever done it before, it was nice that nobody ever told us not to. Like, NBC was really supportive. I think NBC also likes the idea of our show being different than The Tonight Show, and I think they just felt a point of view. I feel like this is an era now, and I think it's a lot of thanks to Jon Stewart and Colbert. Like, it's okay to have a point of view and be a talk show host.
I mean, what I feel like I appreciate about what you guys are doing and like your interview with Kellyanne Conway is one of the frustrating things about watching this campaign is the degree to which they just insult your intelligence.
Yeah.
And like blatant lies to your face, and to have someone call it out and like, you know, to do it with satire, I think is like one of the best ways to cut through that bullshit.
What was nice, I will say, I'm very grateful that she came.
Yeah,
because it's so hard to have those conversations. Yeah. And it was funny because a couple weeks before, I had back-to-back nights. David Remnick had been on, and the next night, Rachel Maddow had been on, and they were very similar conversations. They were just like the progressive lament.
Right.
And
I felt like when I was watching you talk to Kellyanne Conway, it was a little bit like, oh my God, she's doing that thing she does in CNN, but she's doing it to me, and I can tell her it's crazy. But she's doing that pivot thing. I'm going to talk about it.
Well, it was the great thing about it, and I realized the advantage I had over somebody who would talk to her on CNN is an audience.
Yeah.
She never gets interviewed in front of an audience. And so there's a moment where I said, that's a pivot. And the whole audience laughed because they, again.
Yeah, you literally applauded her.
And then she couldn't then say it wasn't a pivot. 200 people agreed with me.
Right.
Whereas on all those shows, you know, you want somebody like Jake Tapper, you want somebody like Anderson Cooper, talk to her. First of all, I don't know how anybody, when you're just two people are in different places looking at the camera, hearing each other in an earpiece, like no one's ever come to an agreement there. And also just that the audience becomes a group of people that sort of collectively say, well, now hold on. And then it doesn't make you as the interviewer look like you just found a bone to pick with them. You're just kind of saying, I just would love to point that out.
Right.
I couldn't remember another late night show host breaking news in the middle of an interview to a guest. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, it was so... I wish you could have seen how... It was like the dressing room was on fire. Like, everybody was running around, like, showing you printouts and reading it and trying to understand the news story. Right. Because I knew
this
I had
to... It was a hard one to
it
understand.
Was,
yes, it was.
Yeah.
It took a couple of days, and we still don't know.
We still don't know. I still don't know if... You know, I don't. I think Kellyanne Conway fully believes that she gave the right answer to that. It's a tricky one. The crazy thing was the BuzzFeed thing was 20 minutes later.
Oh.
And our show had already started.
Oof.
Thank God.
I was wondering why there was no pee jokes.
Yeah, well, that would have been too much to know what to do with.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm glad we had a night
to process it.
To process that.
Yeah, we're still processing.
Yeah.
It's still something we're working
on.
And
I still can't process. You know, I actually now... And again, like, we'll do it tonight. We'll probably faint towards it. It's been for late night talk show hosts that the BuzzFeed document, you know, that is comedy gold.
Yes.
I don't know if it's fair to continue bringing it up because it's so...
Do you think it's fair that the logo for our podcast is holding an umbrella?
I mean, the fact that Jim Clapper, the director of national intelligence, briefed to the president of the United States that he used the words golden shower. I think to me, like, I can't vet this document either. And, like, I think we all should greet all intelligence leaks with with some skepticism, right? But, like, and I'd say this is a guy who worked in national security. That said, like, when it gets briefed at that level, like, you just that has to be taken on board as news. I don't know how you – and this thing was floating around for months before this, but
– I agree that it's news. I just now – it seems there's no verification it happened.
Nothing.
And yet we, again, in order to make the jokes, we don't have before each joke say unverified.
Right.
You know, we
allegedly. Yeah.
Look, BuzzFeed broke the seal on this whole thing. I think that's the first time I've used that one.
I think that's it. Yeah, I maybe haven't heard that one. Yeah.
Everybody, you're welcome.
What do you think about the role of comedy in, I guess, in the Trump era here? Because there was, during the campaign, there was a little sniping from, I would say, Republicans and then, like, DC types. It's like, oh, John Oliver did a segment Sunday night, but it didn't kill Donald Trump's campaign. Like,
right.
Thought it was going to, you know, and sort of mocking it.
Well, I think there's it's fair to mock those who write headlines that use destroy.
Right.
And I think even John has done that to his credit. I mean, none of us, I mean, again, we don't ever write one where we, you know, it comes off the printer and we say, this is the one.
We got him.
We got him. We're just happy to be able to talk about what's going on in the news and make jokes about it. We also try, and again, we have the luxury of doing it every night, so we have some time. We try to make sure people know he did this. Whether that matters to you or not, like, you know, when people say, why are you so obsessed with him? Well, first of all, I'm not obsessed with him, but he's the most unique president we've ever had. Yeah. It's the most unconventional campaign we ever saw. And so it's kind of, it looks to be interesting in perpetuity. We'll see what happens if it ever gets boring.
That's our bet.
Yeah. But yeah, so we don't, you know, you're not out trying to stop him. I mean, again, you guys must think about this all the time now, which, again, this idea of a bubble. And I'm very aware that there were probably people who watched my show more when it was the apolitical show that kind of led out of The Tonight Show who have been turned off by it. I would hope that maybe an equal amount of people then found it because it was what they wanted. But I'm aware that more often than not, I'm probably preaching to the choir than, you know, having undecided voters come sit in the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when it comes to someone like Trump, who is not normal, and he kind of is in this comedy world, right? I think that there are shows that have taken it on, and then there are shows that said, you know what, we're just comedy shows. We're just going to keep doing our thing. Do you think that you have an obligation to ask tough questions, say, of a Donald Trump? Do you have an obligation to not treat him as normal?
I don't know if it's an obligation. I mean, again, and I'm not trying to deflect. I'm just trying to do the best show every night. And I find the best version of our show is sort of questioning what he does. It's the best version. And again, every talk show has to build itself around the skills of the host. I feel like that is just there are other things I can't do that other talk show hosts are really good at. But I do think one of the things I can do is at least try to deconstruct what he's doing every day and with jokes. I mean, it's kind of that simple.
Does a lot of it come from what you did on Update, just because that's sort of the style that...
I think the most helpful thing in Update was just learning how to look down a camera and talk, right. Just tell jokes, because it is very jarring to do. I think as stiff as I was, because I do feel like I was really stiff when I first started doing monologues on this show, I was really stiff when I first started doing jokes at Update. For some reason, I finally got good at sitting behind a desk and then started a new job and was like, I'm going to leave my skill set. You guys remember me being wooden back in 05? Well, here I am again.
What is it about standing up that made it different?
One thing is it's a little bit more old school entertainer.
Right.
I think that, you know, the curtain and, you know, we switched it to a brick wall. There's something that you feel like you want to see a showman. And I didn't even know where to put my hands like that.
Right. You see where Conan like ends up like doing dances with strings. He's like, what am I doing with my hands out here?
Yeah. Well, it was funny. I mean, I feel like he figured it out and turned it into a strength of kind of calling out how silly it is that you have to. And again, couldn't figure out hand in a pocket or any of those things. And I always felt like it had no looseness for me. I felt like I was like doing a catalog shoot, you know, that thing where you like hand pocket, look at watch, point.
Why do you think there's no conservative version of what you're doing or that I can think of?
I don't know. It's such a good question.
Because shitting on Democrats is easy and yeah. fun. We are terrible.
Right. No, a mess.
I mean,
an absolute mess. This would, coming out of maybe the worst like year the Democrats have ever had.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't really want to guess.
Maybe it's partly because like Hillary Clinton has so few flaws to criticize.
Yeah, I think that was
There's
it.
Not a lot of openings.
Right.
She's such a perfect
Remember
candidate.
Last night at dinner when Lovett said we were going to book her? We got this.
There goes
the
that.
Excuse me. This is still possible and I could go further.
Editing works wonders.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of who even counts as a conservative comedian. I know there are comedians out there who hold conservative
right.
Perspectives, but it doesn't seem like anybody wants to go out and do the work of trying to...
Maybe because it's hard?
It might be hard. It might come off as mean-spirited. And I don't know why... I mean, I'm sure, by the way, conservatives are like, trust me, you come off as very mean-spirited to us.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm worried. There's never been... Empathy has never been... asked for more by the winners in history.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I jumped to, there was a lack of empathy. But now, a few months in, I mean, why are the winners the ones who also get empathy?
Fascinating to see, like, you know, Trump's spokesman saying, I have to tell you, Saturday Night Live was very mean spirited. Are you kidding? You work for Donald Trump. He's the meanest guy we've ever elected.
Yeah.
He's a famous jerk.
Yeah. He's world class mean spirited. And yet, there's this idea that everybody, none of us understood the lives of the people who made this decision. And I get it. I feel like this was an election that you have to have an intellectual curiosity as to why it happened and try to think more about people that you haven't thought of before. But it is this weird thing of like, shouldn't there be some empathy for the people who right. also lost and are going to have...
I mean, I feel like I've read every article there has been written about why we lost this election, and I have a less good understanding now than the day it happened. And I think, yes, we didn't do a good job reaching out to white working class voters, and the message was terrible, but I don't want to overlearn this lesson. And I think to the extent I have empathy right now, it's like for anyone who's Muslim in this country and or right. someone who's, you know, could be sent home to another country, and it's immigration debate. I mean, like, those are the people who deserve some empathy.
Piping Tommy in from the Women's March.
But it's this weird thing of you have to, we get empathy, and you have to be good sports.
Yes.
It's weird. Yeah. It's a sore winner thing.
The sore winner thing is crazy.
I've never seen it before.
No.
It's pathetic.
It's almost as if he attracts a kind of devious and unprepared
person. It's like they're all Boston
him.
Sports fans, is what that is.
It's true. Give him a chance, which I, again, you know, I'm still hopeful that I don't know how it happens, but that, you know, we're better off a year from now than we are today. Like, that's the hope. And yet this idea of give him a chance, I mean, by the day after, he was behaving terribly. Right. There was no shift. And so I think there's this idea that no one who wanted the other option or the other outcome gave him a chance. But it's like, no, there's an active...
I mean, also, once you become president, like, the stresses and challenges only increase, right?
Yes.
It's like, right. You get, like, more in the foxhole, and you feel more defensive, right? Like it's not going to get better for him.
The flaws of presidential candidates are the flaws that dog their presidencies only worse, because you're a human being in the craziest job human beings have ever created, and it brings out all your worst instincts, because... You're a human being. You're a person.
And you feel aggrieved. Go ahead.
I was just to say, obviously, President Obama seemed to have, you know, a very strong historic sense of what he was about to step into. How much harder do you think it was than even he was prepared for?
I think it was much harder. I remember in those, the only time I thought I saw him seem nervous was those first few months on the job because of the economic crisis and the reports he was getting. And just like every day it was more bad news, like... Auto industry's dying, 800,000 jobs a month losing, like credits frozen up.
And that started in the campaign. Remember when we all like surreptitiously patched into that conference call in October when he had just gone to the White House? And like that was when Hank Paulson got down on his knees in front of Pelosi and was begging her to support
to vote for the bailout.
The Republicans wouldn't back it.
And he was like, we got to win this thing, guys. Like things are way worse than you
realize. Yeah, because Obama was in this meeting with Bush and Paulson and Pelosi and McCain, and they were talking about the financial crisis. And I remember Bush had seemed a bit adrift because he was almost done. And Paulson sort of had everything under control, I guess.
And McCain wouldn't talk.
Yeah, but Obama got on the call after that and he was more scared and worried than he had ever been during the campaign, because he was like, I'm probably going to become president, and this is really fucking serious.
Yeah. Demanding. That incredible Onion headline. Black man gets worse job than married.
Well, look, the good news is there are always four-year stretches in America without a crisis. That happens all the time. Yeah. So nothing to worry about on that front.
It's incredible also, I mean, people have already forgotten how crazy it was when Obama took office.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was as bad as Trump is making it seem. It's bad. Now.
I was saying that the other day. I'm like, can you imagine if Trump was taking office in 2009 right now?
Yeah.
Then I'd be really terrified. Like, at the very least, we have some level of mm-hmm. calm and prosperity.
But to your point about the sore winter thing, I mean, like, the thing that's important about shows like yours is, like, this first 6 months or a year in Washington, the sucking up from the non-Jake Tappers of the world is disgusting, right? Like,
yeah.
Who's up? Who's got the best office? Who's in power? And, like, someone needs to not give a shit about access and just go after these people every single night.
Well, it's great to not... I mean, again, there's not that much access other than Trump. I think Kellyanne Conway is probably the best person you could have to be the voice of him. Mm-hmm. Also, to her credit, you know, she's done Bill Maher. Like, she knows the difference.
She's tough, man. She's tough. She'll go out there and take hits and try. And
she's good at her job.
And I think I do want to stress this because I feel like people maybe would be surprised. Here, it could not have been nicer before. It could not have been nicer after. And I think loves the theater of doing mm-hmm. one of these that has an audience. And so hopefully... You know, access won't dry up there, but otherwise we are in a good situation, which is unlike, you know, the people in news who actually need it like that. You know, we can just talk. We more often than not, the news is doing the work, and then we take their clips and make jokes about them.
Yeah.
And, you know, so
us too.
Yeah, exactly. But it must be so much of a scarier time for them than it is for the people in comedy.
You do need, though, a chronicle almost of, like, all the crazy things that happened today. Like, I feel like that's why some of the stuff you do is helpful, because... You see a day of news, he, like, yells about a million things, tweets, like, a bunch of things happen that any one of them would have been talked about for days.
Yeah.
And then it's easy to just forget the next day.
Well, that, it is, I mean, hopefully each day's thing serves as a document for people who missed the day and just want to hear. Because, again, I don't know if we're changing minds, but if everything I'm telling you is depressing, hopefully this is the most palatable way to get this news.
Yeah, right.
You know, already, as opposed to if you watch, you know, CNN, you have to watch a panel of people who are very fraught talking about the outcome, and this has never happened, this is unprecedented. Yep. Whereas by the time you get it, it gets to us, we can at least be rolling our eyes at it.
Right.
And that doesn't make it any less dangerous, what is actually happening, but hopefully it makes it a more palatable way to accept the danger.
And to John's point, like, the half-life of a bad story these days is like the snap of a finger. Like, I remember where I was when I first saw the Reverend Wright video. It was like when Kennedy was shot. And we never stopped talking about it for like 3 months. The man talked about groping women on tape, and like, it's just kind of a...
Today, I think it was earlier today, Trump spokesman did a press conference and was asked, you know, will he ever release his return so we can find out where he owes money? And he's like, oh, that's asked and answered. Like, No. Yeah. It's asked and asked and asked, but never answered.
Right.
And it's just, they're like, you can just move on. They're, what they're doing is the kind of thing I feel like political operatives have talked about forever. Like, what would happen if we just never dealt with it?
Yeah.
Would it really go away? And, oh, no, it does.
Mm-hmm. And then, I guess the terrifying thing is, I mean, look, anybody who has any expectation that he's going to change is crazy, I think, at this point.
Definitely.
But will this change the way other people run for office because it was so effective?
That's scary.
That's the scary thing.
Definitely.
You can get away with a lot now.
Yeah.
And look, you know, he is a unique guy, and it's easy to, because he has been so malicious in so many ways, it's easy to overlook his strengths. He's charismatic. He has a sixth sense for the media. But what scares me is, okay, you can jettison the racism. Because it's not a winning strategy long term, right? America's changing.
Yeah.
What do you keep? You keep the lying. You keep the constantly keeping people onto the next story. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be consistent. You don't need your policies to connect to what you say on a day-to-day basis. You put the racism aside, there's still a basket of horrible behaviors that people can learn from.
Yeah. And just dismissing the press. Like, the ability to sort of wholesale push them off to the side.
Yeah.
Just to go in, like, that thing you were saying about how the half-life, like, so the piece we're going to do tonight, The Closer Look, it's basically an inauguration preview. And then Sal Gentile, the guy who wrote it, put on confirmation stuff at the end. And it definitely feels like a little bit, we thought, oh, maybe we should save confirmation stuff for Monday. But Sal's been doing this long enough, and he was saying, it's not going to be a story on Monday.
Monday's a lifetime.
Like, Betsy DeVos has, like, 5 seconds that you can talk about
She'll
her.
She'll be, like, at a ribbon cutting at a school as education secretary by Monday.
The first ribbon cutting to close a school.
They're putting a ribbon back together in front of a school. They're police taping a school.
Yeah, no, all the outrage goes away really fast. Yeah, and then there's something new to be outraged about the next day.
And when we take... because we're probably averaging about 3 a week. So that means 1 day a week. We don't have a closer look. And it's amazing how you can't even get a day ahead because you go, oh, and that one at least we'll have 2 days to work on it because it all just like flushes out so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, our preparation is like John writes an outline and forwards it to us and we rewrite the thing 3 times before Monday when we tape.
And usually it's outdated by the time it's aired, right?
Yeah. We miss every big story. Literally.
No, it's true. Who's the most human politician you've interviewed that you didn't think like this is someone just sort of spitting talk?
Well, I will say it was especially this year when you have there were so many candidates on the Republican side and you just realize how many of them don't understand the purposes of coming on a show like mine,
right?
And they, you know, people like Kasich and Martin O'Malley, who are lovely people, but just like locked into talking points that they would do anywhere, and you could just feel them. And I will say Kasich came back a second time and was much better and even said that when he watched it, he realized, oh, this is not the show to do your meet the press talking points.
Right, yeah.
The audience didn't care. They had an assumption. Oh, we thought if you were showing up for the 12:30 show, you were going to show it another side of yourself. I mean, Bernie is human in that it's just the most human behavior.
It's who he is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We basically had him when he announced, so he was this crazy long shot. And then the second time we had him was, oh, hey, is this a real thing? It was like after Michigan. And then the last time we had him was sort of right after, it was right before the election. We had him 4 times, I guess. But like right before the election, I remember saying, how you doing? He's like, I'm bad. I'm mad. I want to be running for president.
Okay.
And you're like, oh, yeah, that's a very good, honest answer. I will say my favorite, again, in the same way that I really enjoyed talking to Kellyanne Conway, Ted Cruz was really a fun interview.
Really?
Yeah, because he... I know. You
first time I heard that.
But he's like intellectually combative in a way that is interesting. Yeah. And he's not... You know, he has that debate background. He's not tied to... You can switch the topic subject on him, and he's like very facile and can kind of go...
As these guys know. I'm a fan of Ted Cruz.
Yeah, you were on board early.
I was on board early. He was my boy. He was the only guy who could stop him. He quit. He gave up. But he could have done it.
Do you think he quit too soon?
I don't think he had a chance. Yeah, I think he quit the very moment he didn't have a chance. But I think there was a period of time when he could have done it.
Yeah. Something unlikable that comes off him that's probably beyond politics.
He must have. Yeah. I mean, again.
His smarminess, I think.
If he'd have just been friendly smarmy to the rest of his party.
Right.
You know, yeah. Like if right. he. But he played that card of I'm going to be the outsider. And then like that dude came out. Like so far outside right, him. So
like you need to have an inside somewhere.
Yeah.
Like it can be small, but you need somewhere where you can go where there are people who like you.
Yeah.
It is funny what goes in, on our side, what goes into like preparing politicians for shows like this.
Sure.
Like there'll be meetings and it's like
right.
come up with lines.
It's and the worst instincts,
like,
right?
We don't want to write them it's, lines.
You're not funny.
Shows.
It
you're
definitely
not supposed to
changed over the years though. I remember like when in the first year, at the White House, when the president would do one of these shows, there was the meeting and you know, writing a page of lines, like maybe he'll use this if he's asked this, and it never comes to anything. And then by like, you know, year four, it's just like, all right, just go and be, just talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Always much better.
I mean, he's the best at it. I want to loop back to the correspondence dinner. What is it going to be like? What is the correspondence dinner going to be like next year?
So I think Al Smith is going to be instructive, what we saw during the campaign, which is he will have a page of professionally written material by someone who has sold their soul. And then he'll turn the page and he'll just be like, you know what? I hate all of you. Mean, 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 no punchline, angry. I hate you. Thank you.
Well, you know, I mean, we've learned that self-deprecating jokes are always the best.
Yeah.
And you always want to start with self-deprecating so that you can get into the shots on other people later. I don't think he will be very self-deprecating.
Yeah.
And he, like you said, he'll take every joke too far. There'll be a joke that singes, and then he'll just hammer it because he wants to really insult.
I felt like that was like a metaphor. You were so close. Like,
did I get it?
I was like, I was like, oh, singeing. Where's he going to go? Hammering. Never mind. Yeah. Disappointed.
Something like Trump might say.
The thing about the Al Smith dinner is he has no expectation of how the joke will go. It's just like it's almost as if he's hearing it the first time as he reads it. And not in that good stand-up way of, oh, they say it and it makes you think it's the first time they're saying it.
Which Obama does sometimes.
Yeah.
Or sometimes he's really reading it for the first time. Yeah. It's been like a speech, a little joke.
But yeah, and I mean, I don't know. I can't even imagine what it'll be like for the comedian.
I was going to say, what comedian does that, gets that job?
Yeah, Larry the Cable Guy. Good luck, my friend.
Well, listen, I mean, the way that he's interacting with the press corps, if this trend continues and they push them out of the West Wing into the EEOB and they are saying no press is allowed in Trump's hotel this weekend, and like if this access keeps being curtailed, reporters should not be a party to this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and like I don't want to be the rain on the parade asshole after I got to go my turn. But like at some point it's not funny because people need to understand that press access is our access to information. And I think it's easy to like, we've shit on the media from both sides for so long that we've destroyed their approval rating. But it's like, this is getting dangerous.
Yeah. The weird thing about any collective press decision is that even possible to ask? You know, when people say, oh, they should walk out of the, you know, the press briefing. Well, not everyone will ever walk
right.
out.
Right.
You'll just be left with, right. And so there's this interesting thing. Some people say you just might have to eat it. The interesting thing would be if the press corps. I mean, again, Trump doesn't want to have that dinner, right? He doesn't want to go to the White House Correspondents' Day.
Although
I don't know.
Now, especially because of 2011, I think the first year he's going to want to go to be like,
I mean,
look
this
at
is
me,
what he
I
thinks
did it.
The job is, yeah. right? It's going to these dinners, getting the Olympics. Like that's in his mind. Like
right.
It's a show, right?
Yeah,
it's a big show.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You know, this is something that reporters talk about. You know. Behind the scenes, it's also something a lot of like press people who work with reporters say. You know, we had Philippe Reines, who worked for Hillary, on our show, and one of the things he said is reporters are going to have to start figuring out how to work together and stop seeing themselves as competitors. And I wonder how much of a challenge the Trump press strategy has to pose before they'll really do that.
But yeah. Like you said, there's like even if ABC, CBS, NBC right. all decided to join together, like Fox and Breitbart are always going
right,
to be there.
Right, they'll always be.
Birth Certificate Weekly.
Yeah, Birth Certificate Weekly.
Love its new outlet.
Yeah, Alinsky Magazine is.
You do the back page, right? You do like a back page story.
You fold it over, and it's always terrible.
he might not want to go just because he may be self-aware enough to know that he's not going to be funny and be scared. That right. he won't get laughs.
I guess the real question, I mean, April is a lifetime away.
It is.
I mean, will before we decide like how it's going to go.
Maybe literally,
the first week.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I can't even imagine what that night's going to be like. I have another question about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Do you guys know the answer to this? I believe that before President Obama started doing it, that the president went second.
No.
No? Are you sure?
For some reason, everybody wants the comedian to have gone first. Like, I think that everyone's like, that makes more sense. Why are we doing it this way? But I remember Wanda Sykes going after Bush and kind of watching Wanda Sykes as I was walking out the door.
Yeah.
At least in the Bush administration, it was that way.
Yeah, I don't know if it ever switched before that.
I mean, it should have. The only reason it should have switched is how good Obama was at it.
Yeah.
Obama was impossible to follow.
Yeah, it's totally home field advantage to the president.
Right.
There, right.
But he has, not only, I'm not just saying this, but fantastic material. He has a stand-ups delivery, even when he's talking about policy. He knows exactly how to deliver a joke.
Yeah.
And I just remember that was the part that, when people say that how stressful was the night, the stressful part was sitting there knowing you had to go up next while he was just murdering, just killing
Did
so
Did you have
hard.
To cross out any jokes? Do we have repeats?
No. It turned out no. I ended up dropping jokes on the fly that were, I sort of had a joke about every 2012 Republican mm-hmm. candidate. And I did a couple of them, and I could tell, like, he wasn't... You could tell the president didn't want to get caught laughing at them. He was happy laughing at Trump. And I just realized, oh, because I found when he gets cold to something, like, the audience kind of does, too, because they can see him watching.
I really think you had one of the great strategies. You did a fantastic job, and I always point to it as, like, that was the best job a comedian did during Obama's two terms in office. Like, look, we're all company. I'm going to get one in. But it was interesting. You had a real strategy, which was you were just relentless with jokes because it's a big spread out room. So you were fast with a lot of jokes, and you were flipping through pages, skipping things you weren't sure were going to work.
Well, you
it was
didn't
really
do too
fascinating
many.
To see.
A lot of the comedians have failed because they don't do as well because they do too many jokes.
Yeah.
And I don't know why in that room they felt they feel like, you know.
And it's such a sensitive, turfy room, too. Like, they get sensitive, like, ooh, at the weirdest things.
There was, I'll tell you after we stop rolling, but John Mulaney and Neil Brennan, who both helped me out, they were sitting at a table, and I skipped a joke, and Mulaney told Neil, oh, I'm so happy he skipped it. I've been so worried about it coming. And like just that thing, because you, and there's no dress rehearsal. So you don't, every joke you tell, you're learning an exponential amount more than what you knew before you told it. And it was just like, oh, and then it was just Cameron wanted to like skipped it. And he said it was like his heart started beating again.
We do this every year where there's jokes that we love.
Yeah.
And then they go and it's nothing. And then there's jokes that we're like, is this too cheesy? And then the audience loves
yeah,
it.
It's a little, it's, yeah, it's a fascinating, that room is, it's, first of all, also, they're never as insidery as you expect them to be.
No.
Right.
Because it's this mix of Hollywood people and DC people who are really more sort of sponsors of these magazines and newspapers.
Yep.
And then there are journalists who are, you know, look, the funniest people in the world. Great senses of humor, one and all. Cheerful, hilarious bunch.
Not the sensitive
House,
at all.
The White House press corps, bunch of prickly pears, those guys.
I remember the other thing was we were supposed to, you know, there's like a photo room beforehand with a, get the, your picture with the president and the first lady. And then there was supposed to be a photo with myself, the president, and the press corps. And he disappeared. And of course, you guys have talked about this, but you know, that was the next day was Osama bin Laden. And I just remember when, like multiple reporters saying they got one of Gaddafi's kids. Like that's, they just killed one of the Gaddafi's kids. And I just remember thinking,
that
like,
was their guess?
That was their guess or something, or like maybe it was one of Saddam Hussein, but like there was something and they were all so sure.
I mean, usually like the next day, you know, John and I had been working on the speech. You know, Tommy's in national security, but we're just working on this joke speech.
Yeah.
And then we're like, I wonder why the president was so busy in the two or three days leading up to the correspondence dinner. We couldn't get any time for this important event.
Yeah. I had to go to the White House the next day and I was like, I got called in and I sort of sensed it was something important, but I didn't know. Like, I wasn't read into this. Yeah. There was no reason to be. And I got to the White House and, like, you know, a headshot of bin Laden with a bullet through his skull was put down in front of me, so it got serious very quickly. But then throughout the day, I would go outside and I would just see, like, the cast of True Blood, like, bitching up a storm they couldn't get a tour. Like, well,
that was the
it'll
real
all
problem.
Make sense in a couple hours.
We had to cut a bin Laden joke, or Obama right. asked us to cut a bin Laden. Did you have a bin Laden
we
joke?
We had one, but it was just, we were just shitting on C-SPAN for how, that's and right. it was... that nobody watches C-SPAN. And I was like, people joke. Have been looking for... Everybody says Osama bin Laden's in the Hindu Kush, but did you know he's hosting a talk show on C-SPAN every day from 2 to 3?
That's right. That's right.
I'm so glad you said shit, because I've been saying it and I got conscious of it.
Oh, okay, yeah, but it was that we always say... that I think told the last bin Laden joke that he would have... He had a chance to hear.
Right. Depending on, like, you know, the Wi-Fi.
Yeah. I like to think of him watching the correspondence dinner. Oh, like, come on, man.
That's going to be the worst thing that's going to happen to me today.
Yeah.
Well, he did sit around all day watching TV of himself.
Yeah.
We released all this video of him just to, like, kind of denigrate the guy and make him look like this sad old man that he was.
Yeah.
Just watch it, complaining about cable news.
Yeah.
He's very, like, very Trump-like.
Bill O'Reilly.
At the end, I got up and... you know, when you finish, and it was as much as, like, I'm pretty sure it was just the president said good job, and I said thanks, so great. It was that fast, but I remember somebody said the next day or 2 days later, whatever, what did you say to the president afterwards? And I was telling people, I said, check about a bed. I said, I've been looking at some Google Earth shots. There seems to be it doesn't fit.
It doesn't hang together.
There's something about
right.
it.
I got a hot tip for you.
Yeah. Why a dish? Why would a house like that have a dish?
Why are these walls so high?
Believe what you will. I'm just saying. You have your intelligence.
The other thing I remember that I walked off stage and Al Franken called me immediately, which was very nice.
That's cool.
Because he had done it a couple times.
Did you see his exchange with Rick Perry today?
Incredible. It's the closer for our closer look. It's
like genuinely hilarious and good-natured on both their sides. Like,
both sides, yes.
Great.
And the best part about it is Rick Perry says the crazy thing, and it's such a gift. Franken, being from comedy, just knows all he has to do is just let it lay there.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
It's awesome.
One of the first times I ever wrote jokes in politics, I was writing jokes for Hillary, and Al Franken was helping. And I made him laugh about Rick Lazio working at a deli in upstate New York, and it was like the greatest thing that ever happened. It's like, Al Franken is a tough audience. That felt awesome.
Yeah. He used to call and yell jokes into an answering machine during John Kerry's presidential campaign.
Why?
Because John Kerry always wanted jokes.
Which
he wanted jokes
machine?
At the top of his speech. And, like, Andre Cherney was the speaker at the time. We'd sit in our office, and we'd be, like, listening to messages from Al Franken, being like, here's what he should say. Here's a couple jokes. John Kerry didn't deliver them quite as good.
No.
Amy Poehler and I were in D.C. for, I think, when... Tina Fey got the Mark Twain Award, and we, Franken had us to lunch in his office. And then he just gave us a tour. And I realized the whole reason he gave us the tour was just to tell us the jokes that he'd come up with about different things that never worked with any of the people that he was spending his time with. He was just so happy to have comedians. Yeah. Like, that looks like Rudy Valley. Like, look at some old. I'm like, okay, cool.
He's getting funnier as a senator now.
He's sort of like, let's start it. He's okay with it.
Yeah, he was very serious for that first term.
I guess if you're a comedian running for office, you sort of have to be, right?
Yeah. And then even after, I guess, when you like win by 400 votes, you don't know, like you don't go into it like guns blazing.
Fair. At least that's what Acorn would have you believe.
I was in Minnesota once and had dinner with him, and it was really funny because so many people were coming up and. You know, you say he was kind of guy. He sits in the middle of the restaurant. He's going to, you know, talk to his constituents. And he was saying, the thing about winning by 400 votes is, like, you have to thank everybody who voted for you, and you have to thank everybody who just didn't vote. Like, you have to have an incredible amount of gratitude for pretty much every single person. Yeah.
So you think you'll get Trump on?
I don't. I really don't. And I'm kind of relieved that it's not something we're chasing.
Yeah.
Because...
Because, again,
if we were... You know, there would be a back and forth, and they would constantly, you know, they could just play us then, we'd love to. I think it'd be helpful if you said mm-hmm. how well attended the inauguration was. I think that would mean, you know, that would be, I wouldn't put it past them to sort of have specific requests.
You're on the mall with a mic, like, three doors down, that was wonderful. What a day. What a day for America.
All the doors showed up. All three.
Feels like Kellyanne might come back on, though.
I hope so. I mean, that was one of the goals, outside of it being a good interview, was doing it in a way that she'd come back. You know, that she's a fantastic resource, and hopefully, you know, you don't want to just strip mine it the first time out so that there's nothing left.
Right.
And I do, you know, there were so many people who, before you interview somebody like that, says, I hope you're going to tell her, and they tell you things, and you're like, oh, no, I'm not. First of all, I wasn't raised to say things like that to anyone.
I'm going
to
yell at my guests for 5 minutes.
Right.
Just to go back, it's very easy for me to book people who share political views, and that can be a really good conversation, a good interview. But moving forward, I think the other is makes very good TV as well. And so it's hopefully trying to find as many of those people as possible.
Well, yeah. Good luck.
Thanks.
If you see Kellyanne, I'll just give you my resume and just sort of slide it after.
What do you want to do for her?
I just miss the White House. I just love
working. Oh, you want to get
there.
Back in there?
You know, support my country. Get back in the game.
Yeah.
It was nice being there yesterday. They do good work.
Yeah. It's going to be a little different.
Yeah, maybe not a good idea.
I don't think we'll be back there for quite a while.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's
take a mental picture, guys.
Seth, thanks for joining our podcast.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoy it, and I'm happy that you're going to be on the show tonight.
Thanks.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. Thanks for listening.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.